Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Frontier Beyond Fear Blog Talk Radio Program and Podcast. I'm your host, Susan Laris and Dance, and I am speaking from beautiful Portland, Oregon, actually just southwest of Portland. And today, I'm actually really delighted to have someone on the show who actually does work in this area. And I think that this show is going to be very powerful for everyone, whether you are engaged in business or in your everyday life. And what we're going to talk about today is negotiation. And I think as we talk to our guest, who is Phil Marcus, who is an expert in negotiation, we will discover that we negotiate far more than we even realize in our life. And yet many of us, quite honestly, avoid it like the plague or feel like we'd like to. And I have to say that this has been a challenging area for me. And so I'm really looking forward to bringing on Phil Marcus. And Phil is the author of the book, Zen and the Art of Negotiation, Successful Negotiation for People Who Hate to Negotiate. Phil has a very impressive, diverse background, which I find so fascinating as a past computer scientist myself, although I still kind of dabble in it. He has bachelor's and master's degrees in electrical engineering from MIT. He studied biophysics at Johns Hopkins. He even taught engineering and physics at the college level, and he has a JD degree from the University of Maryland School of Law. And it is through his experience as a lawyer, also founding multiple businesses, serving on the boards of six organizations, Phil has addressed many issues that businesses encounter. And in that process, he has become an expert negotiator and mentor. And he does assist people professionally now with a number of small business and other business-oriented things, including negotiation, intellectual property law, and other legal matters. And today what we're bringing into the table is his expertise on negotiation. And I have a couple of websites up on the show page. You can learn more about Phil's services at negotiationpro.com/negot.html. So if you'd like to learn more about him, that's a good place to go, as well as yourzenspace.com, where you can learn about his book. Now, I want to say, before I bring him on the line, a little bit about his book. I will say that it is a powerful book that I have had the opportunity to read, and I think the book alone will be helpful to me going forward without a doubt. And here is something that Tim Durrell, who is also a JD with a number of accomplishments, said. Quote, "Other negotiating books teach you tips and tricks. Phil Marcus teaches you how to completely change your mind and its focus, then teaches you how to enjoy negotiating and get the success you are entitled to." And you can read more of these testimonials also on the show page. You'll see them kind of flashing up as we talk. And so without further delay, I am absolutely delighted to bring Phil Marcus on the show. Welcome, Phil.
Thank you very much for that wonderful introduction and for the opportunity to talk with your audience, and good afternoon.
Well, good afternoon to you, too, and let me say that people could be listening. We have such an interesting audience listening into this show. Lately, we've even been getting some international listeners. So welcome to all the audience, wherever they are, I guess. But I am so happy to have you on, Phil. And I really do feel that this is an area which, quite honestly, is the bane of many of our existences, or feels that way. That's the way it's felt for me. Either we feel like we're being too nice, or we feel like, and you know, we give away everything, or, you know, sometimes it can go the opposite way. So can you tell us, Phil, what really, before we go on, what is, let's define our terms. What is the purpose of negotiation? How do we find ourselves in situations where we're negotiating or bargaining, and how often can that come up?
Well, it can come up almost all the time, especially if you have kids. I can remember, I don't have any young kids now, but I can remember when I did. And one, for example, bargains over whether they're going to go to sleep at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock at night.
Yes.
And interestingly, kids are pretty good negotiators. They know how to push your buttons, et cetera, et cetera. But it is not in the interest of the parent to allow a child, a small child, to be a good negotiator, because the parent wants to win the negotiation.
Yes.
And the child go to sleep at 8 o'clock, for example. So we educate them out of their negotiation skills. Now, it doesn't always work. There are some that remain very good negotiators, but the parent's objective usually is to get them to be bad negotiators.
Yes.
But to address the principal question, what is the purpose of negotiation? There is only one purpose of a negotiation session, and that is to make a deal. And people tend to, let me try that again. The only purpose of a negotiation is to make a deal.
Mm-hmm.
People sometimes approach a negotiation as if the purpose were to beat up on the person on the other side, sometimes called the counterparty, or to make the other side feel bad, or to teach them a lesson, or to beat them, to simply win and the other side loses.
Yes.
None of those are really appropriate. You're wasting everybody's time and energy. Both sides are going to get emotionally wound up, and you are not going to get to a bargain.
Isn't it true, Phil, that when we make a meaningful deal, it's in the interests of both parties? Like, even as a parent, I am a parent of a teenager. Deep down, mm-hmm. we know as parents, this is the simplest of levels, that it actually is in the best interest of our child for them to go to sleep. And that it's in my best interest as a parent, too. And there's something very subtle about that, isn't there? That there's this power of the deal that both parties benefit. Is that true?
Well, not from every deal. I have to say there are many deals that are struck.
Uh-huh.
And I'll give you an example in a moment that are not sustainable deals. That is, one party pressures the other party to make a deal, and the party who perceives they have less power makes the deal. Let me give you an example from political life. We are right now in a situation with a so-called fiscal cliff.
Yes.
Now, that fiscal cliff is the result of a deal that was made, largely between Republicans and Democrats. And I'm not going to take either side in it, but about the beginning of August of 2011, there was a problem about what the national debt limit should be, and it became embedded in discussions of all kinds of other national financial matters. And in order to get past the deadline that was looming, what both sides did is to make this really horrific deal about
yes.
what would happen on January 1st of 13, which is the cliff. I'm
right.
not
they
sure it's exactly
it.
A cliff, but it was created. Now, that was intended to be. It's
yes.
intended to be a
yes.
non-sustainable deal. It was not intended to be a deal that could solve any problems or last forever, or at least for a long time. It was intended to blow up.
Right. It have embedded in it things that both parties hated. I mean, absolutely despised. I mean, and that's what makes it a clip.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Some of those pieces both sides hate.
Yes.
In fact, many of them both sides hate it. They were put in there, they're like a C4 charge or something like that, and intended to blow up. Now, there are many bargains that are made that are not intended to blow up.
Right.
But they're bad from the start. That is, one side or the other gets the advantage somehow of having made a deal. You know, perhaps because of a dissymmetry of size, a power, something like that. Those deals come apart by themselves.
Yeah.
People who contract, for example, to sell 1,000 widgets at below their own wholesale cost. They don't want to deliver it below their wholesale cost because they'll lose money. So they have trouble fulfilling the deal. You mean, I thought I shipped those to you a week ago. You mean you don't have them yet? Of course, that's not true. Or from the other perspective, somebody feels they're overpaying. Gee, I thought I sent you a check next week. Let me look into it and I'll get back to you. And that check takes, 80 or 90 days to eventually get cut. There's a message in that. Maybe it never gets cut. Maybe the person who feels they were ripped off simply never pays. Sue me. Or, take less than what you're entitled to and you won't have to sue me. So those deals are not very good deals. And there really is no advantage to winning by intimidation. But you get a deal short term, and then it will come apart fairly soon after the ink dries. Maybe that's a bad metaphor. Ink actually used to take time to dry.
Although I don't know if you have an inkjet printer, I think sometimes.
Yeah, maybe it
although
takes,
it's a little
takes
bit
a while,
different.
Yes.
You're not actually signing.
But that's true.
I feel like many of us have been party to deals that deep down we know they don't feel right. And yes, it's horrible. It's some kind of dishonesty enters into it where people are, essentially violating even what's been discussed. But do you think that as you're in the process, and I may be jumping ahead a little bit here, but it came to mind, as you're in the process of negotiating, Phil, do we either just sort of deaden our senses to the fact that this really isn't in my best interest, or can we really be aware that, hey, be mindful? I think this is what you talked about with your Zen space, for example. Be mindful of how this deal really feels. Does it feel fair?
Yeah, what I really talk about in the first two chapters of the book is getting yourself prepared emotionally.
Yeah.
People who do negotiation for a living have gotten past, if they're successful at it, have gotten past the point of being afraid to be in the negotiation.
Yes.
But for many people, negotiating in a formal way is very unusual. It's not part of their daily life. And it really is scary. For example, to go see a car dealer and negotiate over the price of a car. Even if you do take advantage of all the data that's available now online about how much the dealer is going to pay wholesale for the car, nonetheless, it's still pretty scary.
It is.
And what I talk about is why it's scary and what goes on in the human brain. Some people are aware that there are actually two human brains. They're both in the same skull. Unlike Steve Martin's Man with Two Brains, who had one of them in the glass jar in a movie about 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, I actually like that movie, Phil. I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah, I did too. I rented it one time and saw it. It was a fun movie, but that's not what I'm talking about.
No, that's not what we're talking about.
We have really two parts to one brain, but they don't cooperate very well.
Right.
We have a part of the brain that has been around developmentally for a very long time, long before they were humans. In fact, it's sometimes called a reptilian brain because even reptiles have this almond-shaped structure called an amygdala, which means almond-shaped. And what it is concerned with is making very, very rapid calculations as to whether it's appropriate at the moment to fight or to flee.
Yes.
Or maybe to hide. It's very fast, but it's not very good at any kind of reasoning, period. It is not able to measure risk versus reward, for example. And you have to do that. And if somebody makes an offer to you of some sort in a deal, you have to be able to evaluate whether that offer, which may be fairly complex, makes sense in the context of your business or your life, etc.
Yes.
The amygdala is absolutely unsuited for that. We do have a very effective part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex. Cortex means husk, the outer part of the brain, and it's in the upper front. It's very, very good at that. However, normally what is functional is the amygdala. That's the default part of the brain. And so what we have to do if we want to be effective is to basically put the amygdala to sleep. And I do not in any sense claim to have invented the method that I expose in the second chapter. The first chapter is why you need to do these techniques, and the second chapter is how to do them. And they've been around for like roughly 1,500 years. And they're called Zen meditation often.
Yeah.
But you don't have to be a Buddhist to do this stuff. There was sort of a revival the beginning part of the 20th century, and those who revived it often call it hypnagogia, entering a hypnagogic state. But whatever you call this, it has to do with basically getting outside of yourself. It's almost hypnotic. It's not literally hypnosis because you're not under the control of somebody else or under the influence of somebody else. But you can get yourself into a state in which you can observe a negotiation or, I suppose, another situation as a disinterested observer, a fly on the wall.
Yes.
What I sometimes talk about is imagine yourself in a movie theater. And you're in the movie theater, and there's a movie on the screen, and there's, you know, sound surrounding you. But you are not seeing the movie from inside your head. Instead, you are watching yourself watch the movie.
Yes.
And it is that kind of state, which in Zen meditation is called mindfulness, that is, I think, the goal. If you can get to this mindful state, which I, what I call your Zen space, during, in fact, a little bit before the negotiation begins, you can, first of all, avoid the problem of the amygdala taking over, being scared by something the person on the other side says. They may try to intimidate, to berate you, etc.
Yes.
And you can see that what they're doing is to rattle your cage and to make it difficult for you to bargain effectively for your side. So that's the objective, to get yourself into the Zen space. You can't do it for the first time just before a bargaining session.
Yeah.
So what you really need to do is to practice beforehand, perhaps long beforehand. You'll actually probably feel better if you can get yourself to do these mental exercises, and they don't take a lot of time, and there's no injections involved. It's painless. In fact, it's actually very pleasant. And there are instructions in the book. You can also look up hypnagogia on the web, and I'm sure you'll find some instructions for how to get to that place. And that is, to me, the number one preparation to do any negotiation, is to get yourself in a space where you can see what is being proposed by your side as well as the other side during the negotiation, and evaluate both of them objectively rather than from behind a curtain of emotion.
I'll shut up.
I've been talking a lot.
No, actually, you've put me into a state of listening, which I appreciate because you're sharing some valuable things. I have a question. As you were speaking, the idea of detachment kept coming up, because I know that I've heard various, various philosophers and teachers have talked about this idea of detaching from outcomes. Although in a negotiation, I would assume you still have to be mindful of your outcome. But when I think about what has frightened me the most, and this is where I'll just get honest about my own, and I know other people have felt this way, it's because you really want it. You know, whatever this thing is that you're going for, it could be a car. You know, you really want that car, or you really want that job, or you really want that opportunity, and you don't want to blow it. So there's your kind of fear. It's sort of fear of your own failure, quite honestly, in, you know, not proceeding well. Yes. And in that, you attach so much to that thing that you want, whatever it is, that you lose all objectivity, or, you know, you are easily, and if someone's very clever, they will easily manipulate you too. If you're dealing with someone who is very skilled at negotiation, they know exactly how to take advantage of you. That's the classic new car situation, isn't it?
Of course it is. And often the way it's done is to have the salesperson offer you a deal.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, you shake hands on it, but I've got to have my manager okay it. The sales guy goes away for a while. Could be the saleswoman. And then comes back. Whether or not the sales manager was even physically present or not is sort of irrelevant, because the person comes back and says, "Oh, I'm sorry, my manager said I can't possibly do this deal. I've got to charge you $1,000 more." Now, you're shocked at that because you thought you had a deal that you could live with, barely, but live with. And now the person comes back with, it's $1,000 more, and you really want the deal. That's the car. You're convinced yourself now that this is the one you wanted. Of course, the salesperson helped you to get convinced. And you're willing to go the extra $1,000 just so you can finish the deal. That's what you want to do now. You want to finish the deal and have the stress go away, because you're stressed out of your mind and you don't know what you're going to do next if you don't get that deal, and your wife is going to be upset with you, and she's sitting there, and what kind of a negotiator are you, et cetera, et cetera. Did I get everybody anxious with that? I tried to.
And, you know, the other thing that comes to mind, and they do this, we all know this, is they make you think, if they're very clever, they make you think you're going to lose it. I mean, they actually take advantage of the fact that you really want this thing, is that, you know, one of the techniques is, well, you know, you only have a limited time, or maybe there's some threat that gets introduced that you could lose
I've got another couple coming in here in 2 hours. They've seen the same car and they want it. So if you don't do the deal, I'll feel bad about it, but I'll have no choice but to sell the car to them. So you better do the deal now.
Right. Or in this job market, you know, they'll remind you of the economy. And we have, you know, just applications, you know, thousands of applicants. And actually, that may even be the truth. I mean, in some cases, very well be true. But if you let that, you know, I have this phrase in my mind where you can easily get into this at all costs mode. Like you're just willing, you know, you want this thing so much. At some point, you just abandon really what's your best interest. And I think that's what's so important. And I know that it's a pitfall I've fallen into. I know that, you know, a lot of people I work with in, I guess you could call it the self-help community, where people are looking to better themselves in different ways. Even this show, that's what it's about. And lots of nice people we're all really nice, a lot of us. And the other thing we tend to do is give away too much. And I had to learn the hard way that actually that leads to an imbalance long term, is that it may feel like you're really helping somebody, you know, in certain situations. Sometimes I guess it's appropriate to make some special situations, whatever, but it can really lead to an imbalance that can cause the long-term situation, whatever it is that you're negotiating for, to fall through. And so that's why, you know, as we're talking balance, I hope people can be guided to balance, including me, you know, as we're going through this. So.
And so the key to obtaining the balance.
Yes.
At least one. There's two keys, really. I haven't mentioned one of them yet.
Yes.
But the first key is to get yourself, during the negotiation and in the time leading up to it, when you're thinking about it, get yourself into a mindful state to think about what you really need. Not
yes.
so much what your position is going to be. People take positions during negotiation. I'll give you no more than $500 for your horse. Now, that's a position. The fact is that you would probably pay $750, and everybody knows that. But you start off with an offer of $500. You need to get away from that and to think about, what do you need the horse for? What is its value going to be to you? Much more objective measures of what a good deal for you would be.
Yes.
And get into your Zen space. But I've now sort of hinted at the second key.
Yes.
The second key has to do with preparing in advance, before you get to the bargaining table, a goal, a very precisely laid out goal of what you want when things are finished. Actually, want is not quite the right word. What you need when the deal is done.
Yes.
You probably should write that down on paper. Writing it down is helpful to understanding it. And if you if you're working for a group, not just yourself, you need to have communicated with the members of the group as much as possible and gotten agreement as to what is the need that you are going to be speaking for at the negotiation. And then you should find an opportunity to exchange with the other side. This is what my need is. I need, frankly, to understand your need before I can make any proposals, because I cannot
mm-hmm.
read your mind.
Right.
And I don't believe you can read my mind either.
Right.
So if our purpose is to make a deal as opposed to tricking one another,
right,
then we should exchange needs in a pretty candid way.
Right.
And that leads to a third point, which is, how do you go about achieving enough trust with the other side, mutual trust?
Yes.
To where you can actually reveal what your need is. And
yes.
what I suggest is to start with something really, really small. I think we can all agree, Mr. or Ms. Counterparty, that whatever comes out of the end must be fair to both sides. Wouldn't you agree that fairness is important?
Yes.
And almost everybody will agree that fairness is important. I think this is probably programmed in to most people in most cultures, maybe all cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Even
so that's
if
an easy
one,
term.
Yes,
to
go ahead.
On. Yes. Well, no, I was just saying you find something that is so simple to agree on. And you know, as you're talking
mm-hmm.
about this, we're not necessarily always hostile coming to the table. You know, when I talk about nice people sitting down, that's almost the hardest part, is that I know there are situations, and we'll talk about that, where people are hostile or doing dysfunctional things, but so often aren't we honestly and in trust coming to the table? I mean, that really does occur, hopefully more and more.
I'm sorry, what was the word?
Well,
we trust the other side?
We're wanting to trust them. Let's just put, and we're genuinely open to finding a win-win situation. Maybe that's the term, is that, you know, we have our objective, but, you know, it's not a hostile situation sitting down, that we really want to find it. And that's our mutual. And when you say we're looking for fairness, you know, that's our mutual goal, even if there is some hostility. So I appreciate that. Anyway, I'll let you go on. I just wanted to interject for a second.
So at that point, where you have asked the other side whether they agree that fairness is important, you need to actually get an answer from them.
Yes.
A not a mumbled answer, but a clear answer. Yes, we agree that the results at the end should be fair. Now, if they say, well, what we're interested in is what we want, and nobody can agree with what's fair, so we're not even going to talk about fairness, pardon me, then it may actually be time to walk away.
Yes.
There are some deals, and this is going to be painful sometimes, but to realize, there are some deals that should not be made because of several things. One is that the other side, unfortunately, has no intention of actually fulfilling their side.
Will they admit that to you? Will they pretend?
No, they probably, would. I actually had a guy I worked for who told me that his objective in negotiation was to, I hope this won't offend anybody, but to screw the other side.
Uh-huh.
That was his purpose.
Well, at least he was honest.
He didn't tell them that until afterwards. Though he did take pride afterwards in saying, hey, I screwed you and this is how I did it. He's not a very pleasant person.
No, that doesn't sound nice, but it sounds like, trust is very important. Is that how to find, and if you feel you're in a negotiation with someone you cannot trust, and can they reveal that to you subtly? Would be my question for you. And if you are, you know, is that then the time to walk away?
I'm not sure. Some people can do a cold read like that. They can just sort of look at a person and ask a few questions.
Now, that may be unfair. It could be wrong. You know, you may misjudge.
You could be wrong.
You can't judge a book by its cover and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's more than telling by its cover. You have to be skilled at doing that. That's a skill set.
Yeah, I can't claim to know.
Nor can I. So what I recommend instead is more preparation. That is, find out in advance, and we can do it much more easily now with the web, using web search. Just find out as much as you can about the counterparty and about their representative.
Yes.
You probably cannot find out that much about an individual automobile salesperson. First of all, they rotate, you know, every Monday and Wednesday to another car store. But you can find out about the reputation of a given dealer. Given dealers, you know, for example, among cars, have good and bad reputations for delivering what they promise and so forth. Do your homework. The more homework you do, the better prepared you are. You know, you got a goal, you know, you have your vision for what you need out of the deal. But you also need to know about the counterparty, pardon me, and if possible, their representatives.
Yes, and you're right. Nowadays, I mean, I just did it yesterday. I need to hire someone who can drive me somewhere in an SUV in another state. And I'd never heard of the place. Someone suggested a place. So what do? You look up. I mean, if there are a whole bunch of complaints, and you have to be careful because sometimes you'll find the one or two unhappy people. They're always going to be that. But you can generally tell, you know, if it's just filled with complaints, you know, this place left me stranded or whatever, then, you know. And so I think we do this all the time in this age of the Internet. You know, it used to be you called the Better Business Bureau. You know, now that's online, too. You know, that's out there. But there's a lot of stuff. And isn't it true, Phil, though, that you sort of have to weigh it because you got to be careful because you're always going to have, I mean, nowadays there are even sometimes people are suing people, you being a lawyer, if a radio, and I don't want to get too off track here, but occasionally things can be posted about businesses and different things that may or may not be true. But you can at least kind of see a trend. That's what I look for with any anyone I'm going to hire to do something.
Yeah, it's possible that somebody would hire somebody to go after a competitor and put bad stuff about a competitor up on the web. And I'm sure that's been done. Whatever that can be done has been done.
Yeah. And sometimes you find nothing. And to me, honestly, no news is good news. I mean, maybe I'm wrong on that, but if I don't find a whole bunch of people complaining, I'm thinking, well, this must be pretty neutral because it takes quite a lot for someone to actually post a compliment. It's far easier to complain.
That's quite true.
So anyway, that's a valuable resource to help establish trust before we're even in negotiation, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Do your homework, research.
Yes. Do a lot of homework.
Yeah, okay.
And part of the homework I adverted to a moment ago, which is getting together with your constituents. And I'd like to, if I may, expand upon that a little bit.
Yes, please do.
A lot of negotiation has to do with the negotiator representing somebody else. Now, obviously, lawyers do and bank officials and a whole bunch of other people. Politicians always do. When the politician is negotiating about a bill in the legislature, anywhere from a board of education or county council or something like that, all the way up to the Congress, there's a specific constituency that they represent that elected them.
Yes.
There are, of course, other constituents that simply paid their way to the election and also want to be heard.
Uh-huh.
And I won't get into that part, but you could be, for example, a union official going into collective bargaining, and you have the union that you represent. More their interest than yours, because you're now working as a union official, not as a union member at this point. So you have to work with your constituency, and that means that you actually have a second negotiation to deal with. You have to negotiate with your constituents as best you can.
Yes.
About their collective vision, which you try to achieve a consensus on, of what you need to get from the negotiations. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, that these cliff negotiations are being so difficult and so lengthy. Why is it taking weeks? Well, a big part of it is that each of it, it's come down to basically the president and Speaker Boehner. Each of them has a constituency, and each of those constituencies is complex. Neither of them is uniform. Boehner has sort of moderate Republicans, and then he's got some really strong valued Republicans who are against any tax increases, et cetera, et cetera.
They've signed the pledge, right?
Right, they've signed the pledge. Similarly, the president has a complex skew of constituents. He's got moderate Democrats, but he also has fairly far-left Democrats who will give up nothing with regard to Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah.
And he's got to go to them and tell them, you know, that's not going to make a deal. You may want that, I may want that, but that's not going to make a deal, and you need to look at what happens otherwise.
Right.
The what happens otherwise, the who.
And
is
it's really
always
bad.
Important. and it may be very bad. It may not be.
Well,
it will
be
with the fiscal cliff.
Yeah, they keep, but now they're reevaluating the cliff. You know, you hear that in the news because now, although now they may actually make a deal, I don't know, but I think there's been some evaluation of the cliff as if to say, I've heard it said, you know, is it really a cliff? As if to soften the blow if the thing doesn't go through. They're kind of almost negotiating with the cliff as they're readjusting their view of it.
Yeah, most economists who looked at the so-called cliff months ago said what the politicians are now saying, well, it isn't really a cliff, it's a ramp.
Yeah, they're finding all euphemisms for it. It's true.
Yeah.
That they're diminishing it, that it's more of a hill or it's a, yeah. But
yeah,
it's still
exactly.
Not good. I mean, no one's saying this is what we want. I mean,
No. Nobody's saying that. And I think that there will be a deal struck, but deals like that usually are struck at the last minute. It will not be before Christmas, but it will be before New Year's. That's my prediction. Of course, I'm not putting any money on the table to back it up.
But both sides seem
to be negotiating, I think, in reasonably good faith now.
Yeah.
But both sides have party wings that will accept nothing like a compromise.
Right.
And so they have to be negotiated with. And I believe that much of what's taking place is not between Obama and Boehner, though that is taking place.
Yes.
But between each of them, probably through aides, and the various pieces of their respective constituencies to get them on board. That's actually the more difficult negotiation. And if you're in a situation where you do represent somebody, a constituency, you would be very wise to understand the need for you to be very transparent with your constituents and negotiate with them. Tell them, keep them apprised of what's going on, including a frank discussion of the what happens otherwise. But even if you're only negotiating for yourself, it's about a car, for example.
Yes.
You're haggling over the price of a car. You need to actually look at the what happens otherwise in an objective way.
I have a question for you. Oh,
yes,
go ahead. Well, it dawned on me as I was thinking about how they're diminishing the cliff. Could they fill in a way, by doing that, be diminishing their fear of the negotiation itself, that if the cliff is so horrible and it's presented that way, can it almost be paralyzing? I mean, I know some of it is maybe just, you know, spin control if they don't agree. I get that. But in a sense, if you're so afraid that the outcome is going to be so bad, can it sometimes be paralyzing to the parties?
To the actual negotiators.
That's my question.
Well, I have a couple of responses to that. One is, yes, if they are not, if you're dealing with people who are not accustomed to negotiating, absolutely, because remember we talked earlier about the amygdala.
Right,
if you
exactly.
really think you're about to fall off of a cliff, wow.
Yeah,
and
nothing's
yes,
more
certainly.
Fearful than that. Yeah, exactly.
It absolutely can paralyze you, and you just go in blubbering into the negotiation table. It almost becomes cartoon-like, perhaps.
Right.
Because you can't get a word out. I do not believe, however, not for the moment, that either the president or the speaker
are without experience.
There's no way you can get to be either in either position without having spent at least 15 or 20 years spending most of your time negotiating.
Exactly.
So they didn't go in with any enormous fears of the fiscal cliff. They both had, a very precise understanding of what was going to happen and what was not going to happen and how long it would take to happen.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we get the information filtered through the media.
Right.
And the media likes to rev things up.
Oh, yeah.
Because it gets people to tune in and buy various periodicals.
Right.
And so they like to talk about a cliff. Horrible, really horrible things are, you know, there are monsters under the bed. There are financial monsters. I've learned over the years never to believe much of what the media say about
financial matters. Yeah, I'm learning that too. I mean, I've heard the term fear porn, for example, that it's just, you know.
That's a new one.
And actually,
I like
people
that.
Get
fear
addicted
porn.
To that. Yeah, I didn't make that up. But it is almost intoxicating. Some people, that they're just so focused on fear-based scenarios. And so anyway, I don't want to get too far afield, because I knew that our time would go by quickly today, as it always seems to. And we've got 15 minutes left, and I didn't want to be remiss in asking you, what should you never do when you're negotiating? What should you never do? What should you avoid?
Several things. I think the biggest one is you should avoid demonizing the folks on the other side.
Yeah.
What I mean by that is, either in discussions with your constituents beforehand or right at the bargaining table, calling the other folks names, such as you're crooked, you're untrustworthy,
mm-hmm.
you're evil. You know, I've heard all kinds of stuff over the years. Any of that stuff poisons the well. It makes it very difficult to come back from.
Yeah.
It makes more likely the possibility of reaching the who, the what happens otherwise.
Yeah.
Because somebody who is bad-mouthed enough is just going to get up and leave. And depending upon, if you're bargaining over a car and you call the car dealer crooked, the worst that can happen is the car dealer refused to sell you the car, so you go to another car dealer and get the same car.
Right.
It's not the end of the world.
Or another one will come up in a couple months, even if it's not there right now. You know, there's that
but
innate
it probably
impatience.
Will be.
That you know, we can be impatient. We want it now, that instant gratification
now.
Culture.
Exactly. But if what we're talking about is avoiding demonization.
Yes.
The what happens otherwise if you're haggling over a car is not all that serious. On the other hand, if what you're negotiating about is some situation which is likely to break into war, actual shooting.
Yes, and that there are people engaged in that.
Already is shooting.
Yes.
Already is shooting.
Yes.
Which there's plenty of in the world. There are always about 10 or 20 wars going on in the world. Have been for decades. Not the same ones, but always have wars. And if you have that kind of situation, and what you're trying to do is to get the truce, or something stronger than the truce that will last for a while, it is not helpful to call the other side bad names.
Right.
It really is not. Although national leaders often do.
Yes.
Because they have to satisfy their constituents. They got to spin up their constituents and persuade the constituents that they're really tough and doing the best for the constituents. And the constituents want to call the people on the other side bad names.
Yes.
Which makes it very difficult to negotiate your way out of war. And if that sounds obvious, but that's why it happens. That's why it's so difficult.
Right.
Other than that, it might be possible to negotiate most wars because there are middle grounds.
Yes.
That people, I'll give you a little land for peace kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Maybe, but not if you keep calling me and my nation bad names. In fact, I'm going to get up right now, and I'm not going to talk to you anymore until I've calmed down, which will take at least several years, during which we'll continue the war.
Yeah.
I have specific instances in mind, and I'm sure everybody else can.
Oh, absolutely.
It's mostly about name calling.
How does this relate to mediation, without getting into too big of a topic, but that came to mind as we're talking, you know, where there's a mediator even people assisting, and I don't know, they're not always mediators, but
difference between mediation and negotiation, and they relate to one another.
Yes.
A mediator is kind of a neutral guide to negotiation.
Uh-huh.
Most often, there are two situations in which a mediator participates, usually paid equally by both sides. One is labor bargaining. In fact, I think there's actually such mediation going on right now in the port situation in Portland. For those of you who are not in Portland, Portland actually has a port, and it's very important to the city.
Yeah.
And there are issues around what stuff the longshore workers are going to get in their new contract, which is, I'm not sure whether it's up soon or it's already expired. I can't remember.
Yeah, I know, but it's been an ongoing dispute. Yeah.
It's been an ongoing dispute for maybe 6 months or something.
Yeah.
And there is a mediator, I think from the Federal Mediation Service. So
yes.
The taxpayers probably pay for it. Trying to get both sides, and what they do is they go back and forth, sometimes not at a bargaining table. Sometimes they make phone calls where neither side is actually at the table. Sometimes called shuttle diplomacy in the diplomatic world.
I've heard of that. They go back
and forth and say, look, you know, the other side is probably, I think, willing to give a little bit on such and such, although they haven't said so explicitly, but I bet I could get them to give on this. But they've been making noises about, in exchange, they want you to give on this other point.
Yes.
And the traditional place for mediation is collective bargaining. It's been around for probably 60 or 70 years. It has been applied more recently in the family law situation, where divorcing parties often get to the point where they absolutely cannot talk. You can't put Mr. and Mrs. at the same bargaining table.
Yes.
Yeah, their lawyers can, but you can't have them there because they just hate each other too much.
Right.
After having loved each other passionately, now it's
yes, unfortunately, I know. Yes.
It happens. And often the way to solve that problem is to have a professional mediator, somebody who has actually been trained on the skills of mediating.
Yes.
Usually they come from the worlds of psychology or law. I have a client who came from the psychology side. I have a cousin that came from the law side who do this now for a living in various parts of the country. But each of them probably does most of their work in divorce situations.
Right.
And it's a guy, and the mediator is in the middle. Media means middle. So they're in the middle. They don't represent either side. They're scrupulously neutral. And the two sides may well be represented by lawyers or by some other form of professional negotiating.
Yeah.
But that's mediation. Neither mediator nor negotiator has anything to do with an arbitrator who is essentially a judge for hire. That's a completely different thing.
Right, because they're going to make a judgment, so to speak.
Yes, they are. They're going to hear a case as if they were a judge. The only difference is they get paid probably by both sides, you know, splitting it, rather than by the taxpayers. And they're a little less formal. But that's really judging.
Well, I had a question, too, I've seen situations, I don't know if it's still being practiced more, is this concept, it happens in divorce in some states, collaborative law, where both parties bring their lawyer to the table to assist them, essentially, and they're trying to come up with the bargain. And in fact, it just dawned on me that in a way, although I don't know if you work in those situations, that's kind of part of what you do, Phil, in some situation, because I've seen that in action, and you know, I don't know, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but there's that concept of having someone assist you who is trained, and you can encounter this in different situations, and maybe people have already seen it if they've ever been in that kind of situation in a divorce where they're trying to come to agreement, and their lawyer is there, and the other lawyer's there, and they're trying to help the parties talk, assuming they can.
What I understand collaborative law to mean, and it often does apply to family law, Though it can also apply to commercial law, where two parties are bargaining over widgets or something like that, that may have been delivered wrong or something. But my understanding is that collaborative law takes the position that a lawyer has, in a sense, two clients, the one that hires them and the other being society's interest in there being a resolution of disputes.
I see.
Okay. I personally, having looked at collaborative law and an organization that advocates it, have decided that that's actually not proper. I don't think
really?
That that's ethical. Yeah, I think that it actually violates the code of professional conduct in that a lawyer is required to zealously represent their client. That's a pretty close to a quotation. And I think the, quote, zealotry, close quote, is removed. Now, having said that, I don't think that it is, let me see how to say this. I think many lawyers, especially in divorce situations, but to some extent in commercial disputes as well, take the position that it would be better if the matter were not settled right away, because if it were not, there would be more billable hours involved.
Well, now
that
can happen, and you do get suspicious of that.
Yes,
it can be very
offensive.
That's also,
by the way, unethical. I got to say that the code does not tell lawyers to do what they can to pad their bills. As a matter of fact, you can get your license suspended for that.
Yeah.
But only if it can be proved. So sometimes lawyers take the position, frankly, that, you know, let's have the two of you fight for a while, and both lawyers will make money off it. That is also not cool.
No, that is not cool.
The lawyer should be talking to their client, each lawyer should be, about the who. What happens if we are not able to make a bargain? It doesn't have to be today, but if we're not able in a reasonable amount of time to make a deal to resolve all these points,
right,
what do you think is going to happen? You know, do you really believe to a moral certainty that you, the client, are absolutely certain to win if it goes to trial?
Yes.
And if so, why do you believe that? And do you understand how uncertain the results of trials are?
Right.
That is a message that has to be given to most clients, because they're sure that justice and American Pie, et cetera, are on their side. And mom also. Their mother says they should win.
Now, I wanted to let you know, Phil, this is so interesting. I know that this really has a very real impact on a lot of people. I'm learning so much through this just based on some of my own experiences. But I wanted to tell, since I'm going to, if it's okay with you, we can bring this show at least slightly into overtime, you know, just like other shows have overtime. But I wanted to tell, are you okay with that for a few minutes, Phil?
For a few minutes.
Yeah,
I do have another appointment.
Yeah. But I wanted to tell anyone listening live that if you want to hear the overtime, you have to dial the teleconference line, which is 310-807-5104, or listen to the podcast. But I also wanted to let people know, to remind them, that your websites are up on the page. And for anyone in the live audience who are leaving us right at this moment, and then we'll just talk a couple more minutes, do you have any messages to leave with them, Phil, as to where to learn about your work?
Well, I do. I have actually two websites. They're really part of the same site, but different pages. Obviously, I've written a book. It's called Zen and the Art of Negotiation. And you can find out more, and in fact, download a page from it for free at yourzenspace.com. That's yourzenspace.com. And there's a place where you can order a copy. And if you order from there, you will get it with a personal inscription.
Yeah.
Or you can get it through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, places like that, or your neighborhood bookseller can get it from you, most likely, get it for you.
Yes.
The other website is negotiationpro.com/negot.html.
Right.
Where it talks about the services I provide, which are either to represent you or to sit by you at the negotiation table while you talk, or to talk with you in advance and kind of talk you through the process of building goals, strategies, and tactics. Thank you.
Yes. Okay, now we're in overtime for just a minute, because I do honor your schedule, so I just
thank you.
I just didn't want it to cut off too quickly, as it sometimes does when we get so involved in mm-hmm. what really is an engaging topic. I mean, we can only brush the surface. Do you do seminars on this, Phil? Are you open to sitting down with groups to talk about this?
I have done. I moved to this area about a year and a half ago, and uh-huh. I have not done a negotiation seminar while I was here.
Uh-huh.
I did do probably 10 of them, I think, while I lived on the East Coast, so I'm certainly amenable
yes.
to doing, you know, like 45 minutes an hour, something like that.
I know that some people may be listening from local chambers of commerce or even non-local. And again, we're talking in the Portland, Oregon area for those of you tuning in elsewhere. How are you open to talking to chambers of commerce?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Now, how far I would drive to do that, Oregon being a very large state.
Yes, it is.
I'm not sure I would drive to Pendleton.
You might have to hire an SUV in some cases.
I might have to hire a helicopter.
Yeah, it's true, especially this time of year.
I drove across the state to get to Portland, and it took us 2 days to cross the state from Ontario. So I am well aware of the large scale of this state. But as long as it's reasonably close in, I would certainly be more than happy to do something like that, either for a chamber of commerce, as you say,
yeah.
Or for a professional organization, you know, a group of doctors, a group of accountants, even a group of lawyers, because negotiation skills are not usually part of the curriculum.
Yeah,
oddly enough, in law school, it certainly was not available to me.
How interesting.
Yeah, it is a little strange. I understand my law school now has a course in the catalog, but they don't necessarily offer the course, so it's not really, you know, terribly helpful. But be that as it may, any kind of professional group. I did a talk for some photographers about, I guess it's almost a month ago now. It was not about negotiation skills. It was about other issues. But any sort of group or chamber of commerce, I would be, you know, happy to do negotiation. And if there are enough people coming, I might even do it in a kimono. I have been
able
to
do it
in
a
kimono.
Oh, my goodness. And there's a picture of you. We did, you know, I found that picture on your website, I have to admit, and I couldn't resist
yes.
putting it up on
right,
the
so
show
you,
page. I love it.
Yes, so, it's that kimono. I still have that kimono. It's
yeah.
in good shape, and I'm willing to wear it for the right group.
I see. Well, in Portland, you might actually find that group. You know, they'd be very welcoming to that. You know.
Probably, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess, again, honoring your schedule, are there any just some final thoughts beyond, you know, people know how to reach you, and I do want to remind people it's on the show page, so it's as easy as clicking on those links and, you know.
You know, I
so,
should mention, if I may, my
yes,
telephone number.
Do.
Actually, I have
yes,
a telephone.
Please. Go right ahead.
410-292-6989. Which sounds like it's not an Oregon number. It isn't. It's a number that I took with me from Maryland. So
yes.
That's 410-292-6989.
Yes. I think a lot of people are doing that these days. We hold on to our phone numbers, and that's normal. But yes,
yeah,
because
I have clients from back east. So
well, absolutely,
I want to
it's
do that.
Becoming very common in business and even personally to do that.
To do that.
Yeah. So, yes,
closing
thoughts.
Closing thoughts. I think what I ought to do, actually, is to sum up the topics that I've talked about.
Yes, I think that would be very helpful.
One is, what are the keys to being successful in negotiation? One, always keep in mind that the purpose is only to make a deal, not to teach a lesson. You really can't teach lessons to adults. You can lead them sometimes to take their own lessons, but you can't teach lessons.
Yes.
Nor can you, you can beat people up during a negotiation, but then you won't make a deal. And you can beat them at the deal. You can win and have them lose, but then those deals come apart.
Yeah.
Very rapidly, and you will end up either having to negotiate again or you'll end up in court, which is a very, very expensive and uncertain thing to do. I do not advocate court.
Not to mention unpleasant.
Certainly unpleasant.
Yes,
certainly
it's
unpleasant.
Stressful. Talk, you know,
stressful.
It's even harder to just say in your Zen space, I would think.
Oh, yeah. And very time-consuming.
Yes.
You know, to spend a lot of time with your lawyer preparing for the litigation. It's just a really bad scene. Very
expensive. Absolutely.
So you want to avoid that by trying to come to a deal that is fair to both sides, what I call a sustainable deal, that actually yields on some points. Often there are points which you don't care about and are really important to the other side, and that you can give away if those points are part of an overall deal. You don't just concede something. You say, well, if we can make a deal, I will include such and such. That's on the table. But I'm not going to give it away right now.
Yes.
The other point is, the other two points, are always make sure that in advance you have articulated to yourself and to your colleagues, your constituents, exactly what the goal is, what your vision is for what you'd like to come out of the negotiation with, and an idea of your strategy to get there. Brushstroke, not specific tactics. And finally, the most important thing is to get yourself into this mindful state. That's what Zen meditation calls it. I call it simply your Zen space, where you are no longer adhering to your own position, but you are almost viewing the thing as a mediator or as a fly in the wall, able to understand that there are things you're asking for that are not fair to the other side or not are completely unacceptable to the other side.
Yeah.
Or that there are things that they're asking for that you really, no matter how much you want to make the deal, you should not do that deal because you're going to hate yourself 2 minutes after you sign the deal.
Right.
Those, I think, are the take-home lessons. And buy my book. That's another take-home lesson.
Yes, which is Zen and the Art of Negotiation, Successful Negotiation for People Who Hate to Negotiate. I really like that title, by the way, because it draws us all in, since so many of us really, really have learned to hate it. And, you know, maybe with the help of people like you, Phil, you know, we can begin to release our fear and those emotions around this. And I really want to thank you, Phil, for being here today. I know all of my audience and the expanded group that I think will be listening today will really benefit from this, even though, of course, we've only brushed the surface of what is a really fascinating topic that impacts all of us. I mean, it really does. Whether you're in business or not, it impacts us all. And you never know when you're going to be in a situation where it could be really helpful. So I just wanted to tell you that I'm truly honored to have such an accomplished person here on the show today. And thank you.
And I thank you for the opportunity to speak with your audience and to give them a few ideas that I've gathered over the years. Thank you very much, and happy holidays to everybody.
Yes, and let me emphasize that, too, to everyone listening. I hope everyone's having a peaceful holiday season. And so thank you again so much.
Mm-hmm.